All right. I'm not talking anymore. There we are. 75. How's that?
75 sounds good to me. Okay. All right. Shall we?
So, Kevin, after all this TGS stuff, I got thinking, you know?
Okay, that's dangerous.
Well, yeah, I know. apart from, like, people insisting that the 3DS is dead and gone, partly because they complain, perhaps rightfully so, that there's going to be a system refresh before too long.
I would say so.
Yeah, I think that's going to be the case. But some people might say it's just to catch up to the PS Vita. But I don't think that's going to be the reason.
Really? What do you think?
Well, you know, the controller, it does make it more like a modern console controller with two analog sticks and four shoulder buttons and the four face buttons and everything else, you know, touch screen and everything.
Yeah, but it's a handheld.
True. But you know, something that they've demoed before with a similar looking unit, albeit it looks like it's a little bit larger, is the Wii U controller.
Oh.
Now when you consider that from what we know anyway, that the screen is the exact same kind, is it capacitive? I don't recall. Whatever the iPhone one isn't, it's the same as the DS.
Yeah.
The DS and the Wii U are the same. It occurred to me, maybe they're angling for the 3DS to be an alternative, or at least like an additional controller that you can use with the Wii U in the future. And just having these games supporting the expanded controls might be a good excuse to get people who don't have a Wii U to upgrade to this new system in the future anyway.
So you're talking about like the integration between the Game Boy Advance and the GameCube?
That too, but I mean, think about it. If it has all the exact same buttons, why can't it just be a Wii U control and maybe even allow some kind of streaming to the screen like the Wii U controller can do? I mean, you know, your system will come with one, of course.
Yeah.
But, you know, when they say they're thinking of doing multiple controllers, yeah, I'm not sure either, because I think the screen resolutions are different.
Yeah, isn't the screen resolution on the 3DS like half of that of the Wii U controller? Something
like that. It's a little worse than that. It's like 320 by 240, and the Wii U controller is like around 800 by something.
No. The 3DS screen has a higher resolution than that. It's like something by 400.
Oh, you're right. That's the bottom screen. I guess the top screen's more like 400. By 240,
yeah,
or something.
I mean, technically it's like 800 by 240, but that's because it's like 400 per eye. That's how they do the 3D effect.
Okay.
And that's why you get better battery life if you turn that off.
But still, that's about half in each dimension, so it's like a quarter of the resolution.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't think it'll be a problem really downscaling. Like, downscaling is just something you can do easily, and if it's...
Nintendo just has a problem upscaling things.
Sorry,
that's for another podcast.
So you know, it's something that to think about anyway. That there's at least some kind of functionality they may be working on that will make it more appealing to excuse a hardware refresh. Because you know, let's face it, the 3DS came out way too early, and this wouldn't have happened if they had waited until like you know this holiday season. Yeah,
maybe I don't know. I think Nintendo really hoped that it would sell. I mean, of course, but like I don't think the controller thing was its problem. Its problem was that it was just way, way, way too expensive.
Well, that was one of the problems. You know, the other problem being if you bought it, it wasn't feature complete. Like a lot of the stuff in the menus just didn't exist yet.
Maybe Nintendo didn't actually anticipate that they would get Monster Hunter, because that game really needs that stick.
Yeah, it seems like something that they probably worked out. I don't know. How long does it take to make a game? Or just like encourage the developer to like port it instead of
My thought is that originally Monster Hunter 3G was going to be a Wii title. That's my guess.
Interesting. Okay.
Because Monster Hunter Tri was, of course, a Wii title.
Sure.
And this is a direct sequel to that one, or expansion, or you know.
Okay.
And so they probably started its life on there, but then they went, this portable has about the power of a Wii, although lower resolution, you know.
Right.
And better shaders. Ouch. But anyway.
Oh.
Yeah, I love the Wii, but a graphical powerhouse it wasn't. So.
Yeah, it's true. It wasn't meant to be. It's all about the interesting new controls.
Am I already referring to the Wii in, like, past tense?
Well, you know,
it's still being sold. It's still being made.
Is anyone buying it? I mean, it is the end of its life cycle. You know, it's been about 5 years as of next month. And that's about average for a Nintendo system.
Speaking of being at the end of a life cycle, I hear you had a birthday.
You calling me old? No, I escaped the Sandmen last year.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yes. Yes.
That's right.
I remember
that's right.
That video.
No, I had a birthday, which, you know, speaking of all this 3D stuff, it's also the 15th anniversary of the N64.
Has it been that long?
Yeah,
already?
Can you believe that? It's almost old enough to drive. In fact, I got mine right after I turned 16. So that tells you how old I am. But I think I got mine before I got my license, technically, for reasons I don't want to get into. But I got it like in November or so, and then the N64, like October, I want to say, something like that. But yeah, but you know, we're talking about you know all this 3D stuff. But you know, back in 1996, 3D meant 3D rendered graphics to the 2D screen, being able to walk in a new dimension, which itself required new controls, hence the analog thumbstick.
Well, we should probably point out that means on a home console system. I mean,
there were
3D arcade games and 3D PC games before this.
Oh yeah, I was playing Quake and Doom well before that, obviously.
I mean, and there were 3D console games too. I mean, if you look at the Mode 7 games,
for
Star Fox was pretty 3D-ish.
I had the 3DFX chip. Yeah. Yeah.
So I mean,
I guess
there was, but this is the first that didn't that was like shaded polygons and you know not looking primitive.
Yeah, higher polygon counts, but like you know mostly they had the control, leading to the very interesting three-pronged N64 controller, which for most games you could just hack off the left side of it and never have to worry about it. But there were times it was nice to use the directional pad, but it's, you know, I don't want to fault Nintendo too much because they never had an analog stick and a directional pad on a controller before, and so sure, maybe Sega and Sony figured out a better way to do it before Nintendo did, but that still meant Nintendo did it first.
Yeah, I think they did. Like Sega had their do you remember the 3D Knights controller?
Yeah, I remember how it looks like a dinner plate, and
yeah,
I laughed
it looks like a dinner
it.
Plate with an analog stick on it. Yeah,
but of course but I have
they,
one
they
re- now.
They released that really soon after the N64. Mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. I was really surprised. I mean, at the time, I was a total Nintendo fanboy, and I'm like, Sega playing copycat, you know?
Yeah,
and they probably were, but it's really hard to play Knights without without that.
It's
or
true.
With that.
It's true. Or at all, yeah. I suppose there's that.
No, but... well, let's... Maybe before we go into our launch stories for this system, because I'm assuming you have one.
Oh, definitely.
Do you remember all the hype before it? Like 2 years of hype or something like that.
I remember it well because I was, at the time, a subscriber to a little magazine you may have heard of called Nintendo Power.
Oh man, yeah. I subscribed to it when they had their free Dragon Warrior promotion.
Oh,
do you remember
grief.
That?
No, I think
if
that was
if you subscribe
before.
To the magazine, you get Dragon Warrior for free because Nintendo had thought Dragon Quest would be the phenomenon it was in Japan, so they produced like I don't know a million copies of Dragon Warrior, and they sold like I don't know eight. You know? Like no one was buying it, so they had,
I played
they
it.
Had, yeah, but like they had all this unsold inventory, tons. So they're like, how do we get rid of this? and so they did a promotion with that. But if Nintendo Power hadn't done that promotion, I think I would have eventually gotten into RPGs still, but it would have been later in my life.
Sure.
Because after I played Dragon Warrior, all I really wanted to play was RPGs.
Mm.
And there just weren't many
right.
good ones. I played so many cruddy RPGs on the Nintendo. What did I play? I played Dungeon Magic, really cruddy.
Oh.
I played, you know, just a bunch of stuff because I was trying to get the feeling I got from Dragon Warrior.
Yeah, yeah. I, you know, honestly, I wasn't really a big RPG person. I didn't even play Final Fantasy.
Really?
And I didn't understand things about Dragon Warrior. Like, I remember I borrowed it from a friend, or I was playing it at his house or something. And yep. and I bought a weapon I thought was really cool, but I didn't realize, you know, I didn't know how to read the stats or anything.
He yeah.
got so mad at me. It's like, I worked so hard to buy that. You have to fight all these monsters and earn enough gold to buy back the weapon that I had before. And it felt like it took forever. I don't know how long.
Yeah, but I mean, you should have been clued into the fact that bamboo pole wasn't as good as flames.
Quiet you. But
yeah,
I mean,
but yeah. Maybe you've been playing a lot of Ninja Turtles, and you know that one has the reach.
Oh, good grief! Yeah, so yeah, the look and feel are, like, you know, etched into my memory. So that was my first, you know, real RPG experience. But I didn't really play any since, and I can't even name one on the N64, mostly because they all went to Sony's PlayStation.
Okay, and yeah. Totally. But why was that? I think, I mean, it was the storage medium, right?
Yeah. I, you know, being a Nintendo Power reader, I was reading about the Ultra 64 and how it was going to use state-of-the-art cartridges.
Before it was the Ultra 64, wasn't it called Project Reality?
Yeah.
Because they talked about how it was going to utilize the power of a silicon graphics workstation.
Yes, and that was exciting to me because I knew what Silicon Graphics was at the time. And
because of Donkey Kong Country?
I think so, but you know, I was just into that sort of thing in general. So like I'm like even in like the Stoughton newspaper, The Hub, like wearing a VR helmet from like circa 1992, 1993. Like in the public library there, like in the basement, they had this whole thing. And we're talking like, you know, CGI 3D graphics,
yeah.
16 colors at best, choppy frame rate, you know, very simple unshaded polygons. So
yeah.
so just the idea of a home console having, because at least at the time, it felt like it was better than the 3D I had on the PC playing, like, you know, Doom and Duke Nukem 3D and stuff like that.
But was it better than the 3D on the Virtual Boy? That's the real question. Which came out before the N64.
Yeah, it did. 2 years. And it's a little different because it was more like 2D sprites that were on a three-dimensional plane.
Definitely.
We really need to do that special, don't we?
We do.
We'll
get there.
I remember all this like just ragging on CDs as a storage format, and I don't know if it was like an ad or actually part like an actual article in the magazine about how like the read speed between a cartridge and a CD was just so drastic. It's like, you know, one was the snail, one was the space shuttle. And the cartridge was a space shuttle. And it's like, why would you have anything slower than a space shuttle?
I got to say, Nintendo Power was responsible for shifting my loyalties a number of times, because I was a reader long before then when there was the planned CD expansion for the Super Nintendo.
Uh-huh.
And in the magazine, they had images of games like The Seventh Guest and Cosmic Osmo.
Right, right.
And they were like, we're going to have a CD expansion for the Super Nintendo. And I went, this is the future. CDs are the future.
Yeah.
Nintendo says that this is the future. I want a CD-based system. Oh, man, I want a CD-based system.
I want to be in the future.
And then about a year later, Nintendo is like, or maybe, no, a couple of years later, Nintendo is like, CDs are the devil. Cartridges. What you had before is all you'll need, possibly with the addition of a zip disk.
right, yeah. And, you know, being kids at the time, and I guess maybe members of the general public weren't privy to this information either, but that's when they had a whole kerfuffle with Sony, which led to the PlayStation. You know, they went with Philips, which led to the CDI, and led to Nintendo having, games on no CD platforms whatsoever, but created three Zelda games.
You never played Hotel Mario?
No, I actually did play Hotel Mario eventually, just a couple of months ago. Very interesting.
It is.
I think I actually played the Zelda game in a store once, and you know, there's no way my parents were going to buy like a $400 system for me.
I have a CDI with Zelda.
Yeah.
We should do an episode.
I have access to a CDI with Zelda.
Oh, great.
All three of them. oh, goodness. See, the thing is, the gameplay in those aren't so bad. It's just the
controller is horrible.
The controller is horrible, too. But you know, so I'm reading Nintendo Power. It's trying to convince me that CDs are the devil. And I'm like, oh, yeah, totally. I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
Not knowing how much it costs to produce the cartridges. How much was it? Do you know?
Someone estimated that, like, it all depended on how much RAM was in them. The lower, you know. Games like the most expensive games were the ones like Conker's Bad Fur Day and the Resident Evil 2, which had tons of flash memory. Well, not flash memory, but you know, RAM chips.
Yeah, RAM. Sorry, yeah, random. No, sorry, it's ROM chips because it's read only memory.
Yes.
Yep. Yes.
Yes. You're right. Sorry. you know, just like then that's the reason why Neo Geo cartridges were so expensive.
Mm-hmm.
Was because of these massive cartridge sizes, and I mean sizes both in the number of megs on there.
Yeah,
because they are physically. I mean, they make VHS tapes look kind of small.
I know, right? That's ridiculous. Yeah, so I think the N64 carts topped out at 64 megabytes, aka 512 megabits.
And Neo Geo cartridges, I got. There's several of them over 700 megabits.
Okay. Yeah.
And wow. I think some of the largest games actually came almost close to that gigabit, the mythical gigabit.
Right. So I mean, you know, that by comparison, like, yeah, they would acknowledge that a CD can have like 700 megabytes. I think it was 640 at the time, around there. But it's like, you know, it accesses that information so slowly, it's just not worth our time, is what they were trying to tell you.
And you know what? I totally believed them at the time, you know?
Yeah.
But, like, I had imagined that the Nintendo 64 would be, like, fully voiced cutscenes, you know, 3D graphics, all this stuff. And it wasn't. The CD systems did that.
Yeah, and what sample sound they did have was terribly compressed. And I didn't understand why that was.
It got better as it went along. Yeah,
it's true. But it took me a while to really get what was going on. But you know, by the time it was too late, I was a Nintendo fanboy. You know, I this is the first system I really bought with my own money. I mean, I bought a Super Nintendo with my own money too, but that was a different situation entirely, and involved a lawsuit of some kind. So,
okay,
I don't know if it was a lawsuit or criminal charges. Well, not against me. I got compensated like enough money to buy a Super Nintendo. Anyway, but you know, this is where I actually saved up my own money, and like I think my dad put up half of it because you know he was the one that you know got me in all this really geeky stuff, and he's you know was reading up on what Silicon Graphics was doing. We were like both big fans of Reboot, you know. So we were like into this stuff. He's like, well, you know, I heard about this. I read about it in like a tech magazine, and I think it'd be really cool to have because I want to see what it can do. So I'm like, great. So I bought it. I remember playing these games in like Toys R Us and stuff just to get a feel for the analog stick.
Yep.
I thought the controller was ugly, but it was so hard for me to get my brain around the idea of moving around in three dimensions at first.
I still have a problem with that.
Yeah.
But I played it at a Blockbuster video. They had a kiosk set up. And I think there were probably other kids behind me waiting to play it, but it was like when you played Mass Effect 3 at the Tokyo Game Show.
Yeah, yeah.
Just absolutely lost in your world. But I was like, look at this. I can move Mario this way, and new this way and this way. You know? I'm like... Okay, there's a moat in the by the castle. Oh wow, the water's moving. That's kind of neat. Oh wow, I can swim in it. You know, it's like you know, unheard of at the time.
And, you know, this is also at the time when I wasn't, like, familiar with the idea of strafing. So I was playing games like Doom and whatnot, but I don't think you could strafe in that game. Like, you could move forward and you could turn.
By Quake, you could, I'm sure. But, okay. But yeah, Wolfenstein, you went whichever way the mouse you moused over to.
So that became, like, the default 3D control. Like, you know, move forward, move backward, turn left, turn right. Yep. You know, Mario 64 had a camera, but it wasn't something you really had to avail yourself of that often.
No.
As I recall. It wasn't until later when I was playing like GoldenEye and there was that control scheme where you could strafe, like, you know, like one, the stick was, I think, the move and, sorry, no, the stick was look and the C buttons, were move.
Yep.
And that's when it like finally clicked. You know, and I was like playing stuff like Quake 2 later on. I was just like, "Oh, this is great! Who would ever not do this?" but then it became really hard because I think also like a lot of N64 games had the look inverted from like what other games would do. So like I can't go back and play GoldenEye now because the look's inverted. I'm just so used to doing it on like you know the 360 that the sticks are swapped and the look's inverted. I just can't do it.
Oh man.
But were you mad when they renamed it the N64?
Like I was.
Nintendo 64?
I was. Because like, I thought Ultra 64 sounded so awesome. And if you remember the cabinets for like Killer Instinct and Cruisin' USA, they had the Ultra 64 logo, which was like, I don't know, it was like chipped out of a block of ice or something. Yeah. It was like really neat looking.
Yeah, and it's like I didn't get the reason for it. And they mentioned it was, you know, to have a unify worldwide branding, which they hadn't had before. Because, you know, at the time I wasn't aware of the Famicom or Super Famicom or how, like, the consoles looked different, you know, even though they existed. So this is the first time that the console looked like one thing and was known by the same name around the world. And that was kind of a big deal.
Well, I mean, they called it the Nintendo Rokujuyon, but,
Which I thought it had the same graphic. But yeah, you know, the Ultra 64, it did sound cool. It was like a progression of, like Super to Ultra, and it's like, of course, I don't know what would have been better, like, you know, having, like, Ultra Mario Brothers versus everything having a 64 after it. Everything.
Wii. They should have called it Wii.
No. So, you know, I got this. I had a friend who actually got, like, almost every game released within the first year.
Oh, wow. All four
of them. No, I mean, like, you know, like, from, like, September to September, like every game that came out. So I was playing stuff like Killer Instinct. I was a big fan of KI 2 in the arcades, and I was really disappointed by how, you know, it's supposed to be superior to these arcade games, right? But like Killer Instinct Gold,
you know, they said that they were using the same hardware, but they didn't.
They really didn't.
Also, they had hard drives inside the arcade machines. Mm. That's where the full motion video and stuff came from.
That
not CDs,
I didn't
but
know.
And I was disappointed with Cruisin' USA. I mean, I thought it looked fine, but like you could like hit deer in the arcade version, and they totally removed that.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the reality is that in order to make these systems affordable and stay at the $200 price point that had been like enshrined in stone since, at least you know, for these non-disc based systems, by which point this was the only one left, I think.
Well, other than portables, okay, it depends what you consider a major contender because the Jaguar was its contemporary.
How much was the Jaguar
when it came out?
Yeah.
250 maybe, I don't know, but it dropped pretty quickly to 150.
Yeah The N64 didn't drop for a long time as I recall.
No, it didn't. I don't know, I have a Jaguar or whatever, and there's some quite good games on it, but it's nothing like the N64. I mean, it's a 64-bit system itself, again debatable, but
right.
Kind of like how the TurboGrafx is a 16-bit system or the Neo Geo is a 24-bit system. It's like one of those kind of fuzzy math type things. But, in fact, they used math as their marketing point because their main rival for the Jaguar was the 3DO. And so they said, 32 bits on this system, 64 bits on this one. Do the math.
Yeah, see, now, and that's just one of those things, like, you know, bits never really meant that much, even in the 16-bit era where this became, like, a thing. And,
exactly.
And, you know, I guess Nintendo was trying to, like, leapfrog the entire 32-bit era, which is, like, what every, you know, PC at the time was running on by that point. Even though I think, Windows 95 been out since, 95, obviously. So for about a year, and that was the first 32-bit Windows operating system ever released, even though all the processors it was running on had been 32-bit the entire time. But I digress. It gave this impression that every time a new console came out, the number of bits doubled. So people are saying, oh, the GameCube's like 128 bits. No, it's not.
Wasn't it actually 64?
Yeah, it was 64. Yeah. I mean, 64 is as high as we go. It's like today, for consumer computers,
For computers, I think
multi-core stuff doesn't count.
I think that the Dreamcast actually was a 128-bit.
No, I think that's nonsense. That doesn't make any sense. I've never heard of 128-bit.
Then again, I fall for a lot of hype. You know
see,
what I mean?
No, it doesn't make any sense. Like, there could be like 264 processors in there, maybe, but that's not the same thing.
That's probably what actually.
I mean, because, you know, just from like a computer hardware standpoint.
It's a 128-bit video game console.
Yeah, who's saying that?
Wikipedia.
All right. This is why I think that's nonsense. It's because the way computers work is there's address space. I don't want to get too technical about this. But like every instruction you send to the CPU has to have all those bits filled. So like, you know, these first 10 bits or so is like this one instruction, and like the next few bits are, you know, this information. So unless it's doing something clever, like cramming 32 bits of address space into two chunks of instead of 64 bit space, and like doing two computations at once very cleverly, which is how, you know, a lot of computers today do it.
It's done as four 32 bit floating point numbers.
Interesting. Okay. So it is a little meaningless because it's still really a 32-bit system.
Pretty much. I mean, because like you can have as large of a bandwidth as you want with those processors, but unless the system has the power to push digits that quickly,
yeah. Like nowadays, we'd have like a quad core instead, which makes much more sense from an architectural standpoint.
Yeah.
So okay.
Anyway. But back to your point, bits don't really matter that much.
Right. So especially because it's been long since outstripped by systems that aren't 64-bit. So that's fine. But it did give that impression. It was slapped onto a lot of game titles in those first few years. They fortunately stopped doing that after a while. But it was just like they have like Super in front of everything, Super Castlevania 4, even though it was.
I'm really glad they didn't do that with GameCube games. Mario Cube.
they have tacked on Wii to the end of a lot of things that were part of a franchise, like Mario Kart.
They have,
Wii.
And they DS was tacked onto tons of stuff, Guilty Gear Dust Strikers or Castlevania Dawn of Sorrow or something. You know.
Very cute.
Yeah, but anyway. But anyway,
yeah.
So my N64 buying story.
Yes,
I didn't buy. This was the last ever system that I was gifted, because it was right around Christmas, and my brother and I really wanted this thing, and I think we did our standard thing of, we will get no birthday or Christmas presents if parents please buy us this thing.
Right.
But it is the first system that I bought games for myself.
Yeah, same here.
My parents did one of those classic parent plays of going, sorry, we can't get you the N64 this year because it's sold out everywhere, and have leading us to believe that we weren't getting one, and then on Christmas Day, getting one.
Nice.
Yeah. I think we had Mario 64 was the only game. Well, by that time, there were only like four games out. I think it was Wave Race, Mario 64, Pilot Wings, and maybe one other. I don't really remember. I know that it is distinguished as having a launch library of two, Pilot Wings and Mario 64. Mm-hmm. That was it. In Japan, it had three. There was also some shogi game.
I don't know what shogi is.
Like Japanese chess.
Oh. Okay.
I think it might have been the game that had the modem in the top.
Oh, that's wild. Okay. Well,
anyway.
Yeah, I did not buy Pilot Wings. I was not ever really interested in that series. So I had Mario 64, and that was it for a long time. But hey, how about the prices of those games, right? First of all, the console didn't have two controllers for the first time ever. It just had the one. And it didn't come with the game packed in, which I was like, what? I have to pay separately for Mario 64? What is this?
I don't think it was the first system ever to only have
the first Nintendo system.
But it was definitely the first Nintendo system, yes.
And I never owned any of the systems besides Nintendo at this point. So.
Oh, and it didn't have a memory pack either.
Nope.
And a lot of the game, and a lot of the early games didn't have battery backups. Mario did, didn't it?
Mario did. The first party games are pretty good about that.
Yeah.
But you know, to save costs, because these things cost so much already, like $50, $60, $70, like $70 for a video game, that was ridiculous. Games did not cost that much. Games still don't cost that much. So I want to
they do in Japan, but
okay. In America, you know,
yes.
this was unheard of. And it was just because the cartridges just cost so much to produce, especially the more memory you threw in there.
Yep.
So you know, this whole thing about the CDs being an inferior medium was just, you know, corporate sniping that became marketing.
Well, I mean, let's take it a little farther back. I mean, we've had a long history of that. Can I bring up blast processing?
You may.
If you remember, Sega said that a lot of the games that they were running couldn't be done on the Super Nintendo, Super Famicom, because they didn't have blast processing. As a kid, I'm like, is this true? have I bet on the wrong horse here? I want blast processing too. I'm sure Nintendo's engineers could make some kind of add-on to get blast processing. of course, blast processing wasn't anything. It was just like,
right.
This is we will do our efficient programming here. Mm-hmm. Although when you do look at it, if you go by actual clock speed in, you know, megahertz.
Right.
The Mega Drive was a faster system than the Super Nintendo.
Right, right. But they still couldn't do as many colors because the graphics chip wasn't as good, you know. No matter how fast it was.
Oh my gosh, I remember an ad that was an ad for Sonic the Hedgehog, and it was out at the same time as Mario for Super Famicom.
Sure.
I think he was wearing a suit, and he was kind of like a used car salesman trying to sell Super Mario World. But the kid who was going was like, "But Sonic's so fast! Look at Sonic! This game looks like more fun." And the salesman was trying to get his attention back, and he's like, "But look at all these radical colors!" And I mean, it was a legitimate thing that it had more colors, but you know, people were buying Sonic instead of Mario because the system was cheaper and it was seen as being cooler.
Yep, definitely.
I mean, that ad, I'm going to try to find that, and I don't even know, but I still remember that ad because I remember it was the first time I thought as a kid, I'm like, well, maybe Sonic is. You know, because I'd played it in the stores, and I'm like, wow, maybe Nintendo really can't do some of those things. when in reality, Nintendo, I mean, the Super Famicom, Super Nintendo had plenty of processing power to do that if necessary.
Sure.
Because they would have just diverted a lot of it to, like, its graphics chip. But
it's funny that you mention Sega, because when I was looking up information for this, I actually found an Ars Technica article. That has an ad for all those Genesis games, and you know, this is more based on the pricing, but like you know, a lot of these are like $50, you know, and I just want to really, really like attack the idea. The whole thing is about the myth of you know, video game pricing are having gone up over time, when really it's been kind of up and down, and adjusted for inflation over 30 years is actually down. So, and you know, like development, you know, sure, you can make a CD or a DVD now for like pennies on the dollar, but you know, it takes like a team of movie makers and millions of dollars to make these epics now, and they can't charge any more for them than they did 30 years ago, more or less.
Well,
you know?
Exactly. Well, when you had games for the Atari 2600 and the Intellivision, a lot of those were like $20.
Yeah.
But they were being made by a team of like five people.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't royalties. Nothing mostly was movie licensed or anything like that.
Right, right.
And then Nintendo brought the price up to $40. I don't know. If I remember 40, if you remember 50, that's possible. I mean, I guess it depends.
Well, see, I didn't know how much Nintendo games cost back in the day because I was like, what, 6? So I took on historical accounts, which, you know, have said up to 50.
It's very possible, especially if they came on like a special cartridge or something.
Right.
But I'm thinking around the $40 point. And then
sure.
Then Super Famicom. Why do I keep saying we're talking about we're kind of trying to talk about American systems here, but I keep yeah, Super Famicom is my default word now. So if I say that in the future, that just means
Super Nintendo.
Yeah,
because
okay.
you weren't in Japan anywhere near that point. So,
I know. But those games were a little more expensive. I think the average price was about, I don't know. I think I remember F-Zero being like $50.
Yeah, it seems reasonable.
And I know I paid at least $60 for Final Fantasy II. But that was at the time on a large size cart. It was on an 8 megabit cart, which most of the games at that time were on 4.
Right. So
or
so,
less.
So 512 sounds huge until you realize that let's see, what's 640 times 8? That's 5120.
So. Well, exactly. When I first learned about emulators, I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe that you could put multiple Super Nintendo games on a floppy disk.
That blew
my mind because these cartridges were big and I assumed the very pinnacle of high-techness. But like my computer at home, I found out, was capable of storing multiple games of those on a $1 disc. And I'm like, for some reason, I refused to believe it when my friend was talking about emulators. He's like, I played Final Fantasy II on my computer. And I'm like, wow, was it on like a CD-ROM or something? And he's like, no, I played it off this disc. And I'm like, you lie.
right. Yeah, see, it's impossible to know stuff like that. You gotta kind of consider like why they were using cartridges in the first place and like why the N64 stuck with it. And that's just because, you know, when you had these TV systems, the games were built into the motherboards, you know. The memory was like soldered in like to the rest of the control units, and you couldn't do anything about it. And so all they had to do to make those interchangeable was to basically, you know, make a daughter board, because, you know, expansion boards for motherboards and computers, you know, had been around for a while. So I had to do was offload your game data onto a separate board and make an interface for it, and voila, you're done. And that's still done today, more or less, with DS carts.
It seemed so impractical to me when I found out about it, because I always assumed, you know, a game for one of the systems was like software, but really it was more like installing a sound card, you know?
Exactly.
Or and more RAM. I mean,
that's precisely why like the Super FX chip works. It's why the sound expansions for Famicom carts works.
The FM synthesis, you mean?
Mm-hmm, yep. Well, because Konami had their own particular brand, like built into cartridges. Who else did? There were three varieties apart from the RAM cartridge that the disk system had.
There was
I cannot recall.
There was one used by the LucasArts for their game Ball Blazer, I remember.
Okay.
But sorry, I'd have to look that up. But Nintendo weren't the only people to do that, of course. The Mega Drive also had a special graphics chip for their version of Virtual Racing.
That was an
$80 game when that came out. I remember that.
Right. Yeah. See, and this was like, you know, par for the course in N64. Like even at the end of its life, you know, you were paying $70, $80 for some of these games. And I paid it, which is why it was so impossible to me that this friend of mine was like getting like these 12 games or so that were released that first year for the N64. He had a job. He was working at a bank. You know, it's like he could afford this.
Maybe
all
robbing the bank as well.
No, he was a teller. it was just silly to make, but you know, that's all his expendable income was used for, because he didn't have to pay rent or buy his own food or anything like that. Mm-hmm. He just worked after school.
This is flash forward a few years to me in the Dreamcast era. So you were totally taken into this though, right? You bought the system, you bought the games, you defended it staunchly.
Yep.
For how long? You're going to tell me until the GameCube came out, aren't you?
Yes. Yes. And it's not because I didn't like the GameCube. It is partly because the GameCube had all of, again, two launch titles, those being Luigi's Mansion, which I refused to buy, and I think Monkey Ball?
Super Monkey Ball.
Was the other one, so I bought Monkey Ball. You know, there was no Mario game yet.
I don't even know what launched in America. In Japan, it was Super Monkey Ball and Luigi's Mansion, and there was one more. What was it? It escapes me now.
Well, even though the prices had normalized by this point to $50 a title for this new generation, somehow it got in my head, even though I had just bought Conker's Bad Fur Day for however much that was, 50, 60 or 70 bucks, I can't remember.
Yep.
Buying Luigi's Mansion for $50 was just going to be too much money. I have no idea what flipped in my head. Maybe it's because it was on a disc.
That's a small one at that. That's strange though, because like PlayStation had set the standard down to about $40 or less, and it also introduced the idea of player's choice games for $20.
Ah, right.
Nintendo had a player's choice series too. I remember this ad.
Yeah, yeah.
And like it seems strange to me now, but like it looked like GoldenEye. In fact, it might have even used the sound effects for GoldenEye. I don't remember. It's been a long time. But instead of the gun hanging there, it was like a pricing gun, and they were going through the stores like pricing down games.
And I
remember that it priced down these games, and the new price was like $40.
Whoa!
And now that I think about it, I mean, that was cheap for a Nintendo cartridge, but that's still a lot of money. You know what I mean?
$40 is priced down. That's like, wow, no.
But like, I mean, to anybody who bought the Sony system or the Saturn, they must have been looking at that and going, ah, so you've priced it down to the most expensive new games on my system, you know?
Yeah, it's crazy.
But it was a cool ad. It was a really cool ad. We should see if we can find that and link it.
Definitely.
So for me, and I guess it's time to bring up my experience. The Nintendo 64, I loved it when it came out. I loved it. I followed it. I was a Nintendo Power subscriber as well. Mm-hmm. Just adored it. And around the time that, and I remember hearing that we were going to get a Final Fantasy VII was going to be out on. In fact, there was a tech demo, and things like Earthbound, you know, 64, and this game called Body Harvest, which did eventually come out, but wasn't nearly as good as it was planned to be. That, you know, the people who made Body Harvest went on to make Grand Theft Auto. DMA Designs, who went on to become Rockstar. Yeah.
Right. Gotcha.
You know, there was so much potential there. And then, this is the turning point for me. The turning point was Quest 64. Did you play Quest 64?
I told you that he bought every game that first year, right?
Was Quest 64 even in the first year? I think it was like beginning of the second. But anyway,
okay, yes, I played Quest 64, and I could, that was the first chink in the armor. That wasn't the turning point for me, but that's when I realized that there was something wrong with what they were telling me, because that was such a terrible game.
Well, I mean, it wasn't even released by Nintendo. It was THQ, which has never, ever made a good game. Sorry. There might be some. But, like, I have never owned a quality THQ game. But strangely enough, I always get suckered in. I own a lot of THQ games. But anyway, as I told you back when I got Dragon Quest, it became my favorite genre, you know?
Right.
And the Super Nintendo was so full of wonderful RPGs. Chrono Trigger, Final Fantasy II, Final Fantasy III. You know, just wonderful games.
Right.
So I'm like, I was expecting Nintendo to carry that on. Because they were the RPG system. I mean, there's just something like 16-bit, you know, Super Famicom RPGs that just, I don't know. when I was at the age where this was, you know, I felt like I was playing just epic, epic games.
Well, you know, I love those games up. And, you know, even though they aren't as polished as stuffed, is that even the right word to use? There's something so artistic about 16-bit, which is why, you know, people still make, like, you know, D-makes and new stuff that's kind of styled.
It ages better,
so,
too.
It ages so well. There's, like, it's as expressive as you need a game to be in a lot of regards, especially if you have the bump and sound chip of the Super Nintendo, you know?
Oh, exactly.
Which was a Sony chip.
Shh, don't.
Don't jump the gun on that one.
Yeah.
We might be talking about that very soon.
I know exactly what you're saying. Like, early PlayStation or Saturn games, I can't even go back to. They just look too ugly to me now. You know, but like, most of my favorite games on even Saturn and PlayStation were ones that came out that had 2D sprites.
Yeah.
I think, I don't know. That's something that I wish would have continued more. Having good graphic hardware and using really large 2D sprites and things like that. That's why I'm still a big fan of Neo Geo, because that's what they did, you know?
Right.
And games like the Demon Blade on Wii and things like that. But it's just something people have kind of ignored.
So like, even though there was more and more evidence that what Nintendo was telling me wasn't exactly true, I, like, fervently clung to this belief, okay?
Were you waiting for the 64DD?
Yeah, I was. I would write to IGN like every other week or so about how stupid it was Nintendo wasn't releasing this thing stateside, or how if it was going to be such a savior for its system, why they didn't include it with the system at launch in the first place, because it provided a rewritable option. This, of course, is before I even knew what the Famicom Disk System was. And it had about as much storage as the top-level carts and probably cost less to produce. So in my mind, it made perfect sense that they would have this as their primary medium, or it would replace the cartridge ones, because, you know, they were getting the pan speed off of them price wise by the PlayStation. Even though I think the system did cost more, you know, you buy two or three games and you made up for that pretty easily.
I was a nerd farther back, maybe like a magazine reading Usenet using nerd, early internet, you know.
Right.
So, like, when the 64DD failed to materialize, even then I was like, huh, it's the Famicom Disk System all over again. And I tried to tell that to people, and they'd be like, the what now?
The what? Huh?
Well, then again, even if you tell it to people now, they'll be like, the what now?
We should just make them watch our show. But, you know, one of the other things that I would use as an excuse for why N64 was superior in cartridges, you know, even though they had these obvious shortcomings, would be the long-term savior of the video game hobby, the collecting portion at least, is that, you know, in 100 years, which is going to work better? This disc-based system with lots of moving parts, you know, lasers out of warp, you know, because the PlayStation was already having these kinds of problems. They even moved the laser away from the power supply eventually because of, like, heat problems warping the laser.
Yep.
I've been told that this is like a myth, and I was like, I've found the systems, and I've seen them move the laser. I have examples, and I was told it's for a different reason entirely. But I was like, nah, that sounds pretty right to me. So someone prove me wrong, listeners out there. But you know, versus cartridges, which is just, you know, all solid state, no moving parts, and those games I bought in that super duper discount bin in Akihabara. I took you there, right?
Yeah, the ones that were labeled junk.
Yeah, they were untested, quote unquote, versus other ones that were like in like cases, you know, like clear plastic cases that they bought specifically for those games to sell to show that it was like, you know, cleaned and new and tested, versus pristine, just like this pile of junk that was like filthy and just like the pins were covered in crap.
Or you actually would physically dig through to find the cartridge you want, just exposed. Exposed pins and stuff. Yeah.
The labels in the back might be like, you know, a little water damage or something like that, or torn.
So how many games from that bin did you buy?
I got dozens.
And how many of them worked?
All of them. I had to do was clean the contacts with 91% isopropyl alcohol. No problem.
Yep. I've encountered and tested literally thousands of Famicom carts in my experience. You know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, I used to have a store and stuff, so...
I've heard of this.
Yeah, but you know, thousands of them, and that totally could not work anymore, totally destroyed. I came over maybe five. I mean, I even had games that had like physical holes in them, and they'd still work.
Right.
You know, they were just made to last. Of course, you do have the problem with games with battery backups that often the battery has died, so you're going to have to go in there and replace the battery. But yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
But, and now CDs are a very dependable media, very much, but the hardware that's going to be used to run them is not going to function for that long.
And CDs can't get scratched, but they can be resurfaced, unless you're talking about Dreamcast games. I think every other disc-based game can be resurfaced without problems.
It all depends which side gets scratched, so.
Oh, yeah, there's that too. But, yeah, so I can see why physical media is not as attractive today. But, you know, at the time, you know, we didn't have the internet as such. You know, it was just getting started in the public consciousness, and there certainly weren't service-based companies out there trying to deliver them to you over the series of tubes. So, I don't – where do we go from here? Because it's like the N64 definitely shook my faith in Nintendo to the point where I realized that they were not the end-all and be-all of gaming. But I stuck around to the end. How about you?
I didn't. It was 1998, and I was near the end of 1998, and I was going off to college. And I anticipated a big fight between my brother and I over who gets to keep the N64, because we both, you know, had claim on it. Because it was a joint Christmas present.
Sure.
And probably more of the games were his than mine. But anyway, I was thinking about it, and I was preparing for this battle, making my reasons why I should have this system. And then I just thought, nah, he can have it. Because Zelda was about to come out, and my brother's a massive Zelda fan.
Right, right.
Or it was already out? Just had come out?
1998 was when it came out, so I think it was that fall.
Okay. So I'm just like, you can have it. Because I had a computer, and I was going to just do computer-y stuff.
Yep.
And actually, the next system I bought was a Panasonic 3DO.
Ooh.
And you know what? I had a blast with that system. And I had a game called Return Fire, which I still think is one of the best games I've ever played. But the system could just do so many things the N64 couldn't. Now, the graphics were not as good. The graphics were not as good at all, but just the ability to do cutscenes and voiceovers and have games of just kind of an epic scale. I regret it now because I missed what many people consider the best games of the N64.
Because I was around to the end, so I got Ocarina of Time, and let me tell you, like, no game tried harder to show you that the N64 could do the same things that Final Fantasy VII could do on the PlayStation. But I got Majora's Mask, which was that 2000? I think it was like early, mid, late 2000, something around there.
Either that or like 99. I don't know. I remember there being a Majora's Mask kiosk next to where the Dreamcast kiosk was. And I remember looking between the two screens, like Soul Calibur on this side, Majora's Mask on this side. And I'm like, one of these games looks a lot better than the other one.
Well, I remember very, very well playing Perfect Dark over the summer of 2000, because that was the last summer I spent at home, because it was after my first year of college, and I hadn't quite completely moved out yet. I was just there for the summer, and I was working, and I would just like have friends over, like playing four-player Perfect Dark all the time, because we loved GoldenEye, and I felt like, you know, Perfect Dark was a really good iterative improvement, and of course I had my RAM expansion by that point, so I could use more than the bare-bones features of that game. And I was waiting so long for Conker's Bad Fur Day before it was called that, before it was just an actual adventure game. And then they decided to just say, screw that, let's make something silly and fun. And they did. And I loved them for it. That made me want to work for Rare, even though I wasn't in England and I was just starting college. Little did I know a few years later that they would totally go to crap and I would be glad I wasn't there, but. You know.
But like I missed all those games. I played Perfect Dark only once. At my ex-girlfriend's house, her brother had it, her younger brother had it, but he didn't have the expansion pack. So I thought, wow, this looks really bad. Because, I was into the Dreamcast by then, and I'm right. like, and I'm just looking at this, and I'm like, ugh, Nintendo.
Yeah.
But like, I've heard that with the expansion pack, it actually looked quite good. I didn't play Majora's Mask until fairly recently.
Wow. It's one of my favorite Zelda games. One of my favorite games ever.
A lot of people say it is, yeah. What else did I miss near the end? Conker's I played because my friend had it.
Sure.
And he had his N64 up in college. So I did get a chance to play that one, and I've been being very impressed by that. But by the time I played Conker, I'd moved on from N64, and I'd moved on from the Panasonic 3DO. And wow. Interesting enough, at this time, I had become a Japanese gamer because I'd moved to the Saturn and Saturn imports specifically. And from that point on, you know, that's I always kept an eye on both sides of the globe.
Yep.
Although I did go back to the N64 for a short amount of time when I helped my brother to acquire the Evangelion 64 game.
There's
an adapter to play it. I still think it's one of the coolest N64 games out there.
So we're at the end though. So
think we are.
Any parting thoughts?
Anything
well,
else?
No, I just. I was just.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Sorry, I was just thinking that I think the N64 was really a revolutionary system for all the reasons we stated, but also because it's. Not for reasons Nintendo really intended, in that it made me want to actually search out the larger context of gaming. And that's partly because I was an adult finally towards the end of its life. But it's also because they really dropped the ball, I think, that generation, as it was the worst selling system of all time for their consoles. No, sorry, the GameCube was slightly worse. I forgot. At that point, it was the worst.
Yeah. Well, if you don't count the Virtual Boy, that is.
It doesn't, but... I don't.
Nintendo chose not to as well. But something that I think is worth pointing out, though, is one of the main problems with Nintendo 64 was that there weren't a lot of games for it. But the ones that did come out for it, I think it would be hard to disagree that there was quite a few quality titles in there.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean?
Yep.
Pretty much everything released by Rare was good. The first-party titles were excellent, and I think that's why so many people still fondly remember the N64.
Yep, definitely.
A lot of people still today say it's their favorite system they ever had.
My wife, who's not a gamer, loved Donkey Kong 64 and Mario Kart 64, and it's because of those games that I can get her to play like Plants vs. Zombies on my 360.
Well, there you go. The four-player thing that we didn't actually mention was another big thing, that it really started the idea of like sitting down at a couch with a group of friends and playing a game.
Yep.
Without having to buy those adapters that no one had, you know.
Although the controllers did cost more than in previous generations, which only increased with the GameCube until they realized they couldn't sustain it anymore and like cut the price in half, like. Right after the middle of its life cycle. But that's, again, another entirely different story.
But I'll tell you one thing that this podcast just did right now is it's inspired me. I think I'm actually going to go and buy an N64.
Heck,
They're about 20 bucks at the real Famicom Dojo.
Yes, do it.
I think I'm going to get, and I'm going to get Snowboard Kids because I remember really liking that one. Quiet you.
Oh, dear. All right. Well, on that note, I think that's all we have for this week. So thanks, everyone,
all
for listening.
All right. And, thanks for listening. And as always, comment. Tell us what you thought of the N64. Was it the system that ended your love of Nintendo or started it? So,
as always, find us on Facebook, Famicom Dojo Twitter, Famicom Dojo, and, of course, the one place to find everything, FamicomDojo.tv. For all of our videos, past, present, and future, as well as podcasts. I think that's a good enough plug, right?
I think so, too.
Awesome.